Hey folks, it's Jeremy Kirkland and you're listening to Blammo. How you doing? If you're new here, welcome to the show. I'm so glad you're here. Are we all good? We all good this week? We're hitting spring. We're hitting full spring. I think the first official day of spring is this coming week. If you're listening to this as a new episode. Here we go, you know, you got your new gear, you're feeling good, probably got some tunes going. And you're probably, if you're smart, because you're all smarties, probably going to be listening to my guest this week, the Lemon Twigs. I have to say, this episode had me just like, I could barely maintain composure trying to interview these two dudes. They're the singer-songwriter Virtuoso Brothers, who are also, I would argue, probably some of the most stylish folks in music. It's funny because as you'll listen to the pod, they kind of, I mean, they banter like crazy. They cut each other off. I mean, it's a great interview, but like one of them usually joins me to interview the other person at the time. I mean, it's just really good. Brian and Michael Daddario, they're just nonstop on this pod. But just hearing their thought process on everything was just honestly really, really refreshing. I've loved these guys for years and was so, so pleased to have them on the show. We chat songwriting, clothes, analog recording, their Jimmy Fallon appearance, which was pretty nuts. Tim Heidecker's Office Hours, the best videos on YouTube, Art Garfunkel, Elton John phone calls, and their new album, A Dream Is All We Know. Let's dig in. So how are you guys doing, man? What's happening?
We're good. We were just working on a music video yesterday and the day before, or the 2 days before.
Yeah, the last 3 days, something like that.
Yeah.
The first two videos we did were like pretty easy because Ambar and Navarro and Max Flick, they like worked on the
videos.
They're
the people
together.
Who directed and DP of the video. We just did for this record. And then they did one on the last record too. But
yeah. So we like just walked onto those shoots basically, and
we only ever would have to say one or two things if they had, you know, wanted our opinion or on anything or anything like that, but we don't really do much when it comes to that.
So the creative was set and you just walked on, just grabbed guitars and went,
which, you know, like usually we because on the last record we started doing our own videos more and kind of maybe even before that, but she's probably like one of very few people that we would trust to just
take care of the whole thing.
So
but this last video we're doing it ourselves, and Michael especially is like doing, you know,
all the like, you know, shot lists and everything like that. And that's
and our friend Paul is, who worked on a couple of our other videos, is like DPing and stuff.
Yeah, it's all on film. So it's like writing out all it's not that hard. It's not like crazy or anything like that. It's just kind of like busy work that's annoying. Like not even doing time, you know, just dragging the thing to the thing and writing out, okay, this is gonna happen there, this is gonna happen there, we're gonna get coverage of the full thing, we're gonna get just close shots there, you know, all that kind of stuff, just to make sure every line is covered and all that, and because we're not just gonna do full performance of the song and then cut it together, you know.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting how music videos have evolved, right? Let's jump on your record, because it's really, really good. And like I first got into you guys when you were on 480. Yeah. And this new record, I mean, correct me if I'm wrong about how this stuff was recorded. So this new one, sonically, you did everything on tape in the room, like Glenn John style, whatever.
Well, the last record, every record we've done has been on tape. It's just a matter of whether or not we mixed it analog or digital. So the first one mixed digital, but I think one of the tracks was an analog mix that was a rough mix. And then second one was all analog mixing, but we were really learning at that point how to do it. So it's really kind of rough. And the analog mixing was probably not the best move at that point. And then the third one is
digital
mixing, but so much. I mean, all the stuff is initially recorded tape. And then whether or not it stays on tape is maybe a matter of if when you do overdubs or if the mixing is just complicated or whatever. So with that third one, there was so much analog stuff done, so much reprocessing and stuff, but in the end it was all these tracks and you had to mix it digital because you had to make sense of it. And then with the one before this new one, it was digital mixing.
Yeah,
we just had so many tracks, so many orchestrations.
Yeah,
it was not feasible to get them, punch them in on tape, you know. We had to record this. And then this new one, because we weren't going to do tons and tons of overdubs, and it was just going to be the two of us, which it pretty much was just the two of us in a room going back and forth, overdubbing and overdubbing.
We could,
with the exception of a few songs
on tape.
Yeah, we were able to mix it
tracks down, and it was fairly simple, most of the mixing, you know.
That's always the preference, is to be able to really do it.
Because there were, with the last album, it's like a cliche, you know, you have so many options digitally that you end up doing 30 mixes, you know, of one song, you know, and they're just all slightly different, you know, mm-hmm. The standards change drastically.
You know, that being said, like when we mixed that album, nothing was shifted. Nothing was, you know, the concept, like it was really just like, if we had endless funds to record a record, we would do it all the way. But it's like, you know what I'm saying? I mean, we'd do it all the way analog.
No, yeah.
It's just kind of a matter of like, okay, this is like
practical.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like, you ever get in your head with that stuff? So I grew up in a recording studio. My dad used to make a bunch of records and stuff. And everything was tape. It was like a giant Atari 16 track. And he was just getting some of the digital stuff. His health got rough. And so, like, you know, and so he started to use Pro Tools a bit, but he would always jump back to analog. And, you know, he would always talk about like the warmth of that. And like Brian Wilson talks about in interviews and stuff too, where he couldn't even tell the difference anymore. And it was more just like, almost psychological, like in your head, like you felt like if it was going to tape, you could get a better performance out of you. Like, has that ever happened with you guys, into which you feel like, okay, we're actually, this isn't red light syndrome. We're recording, we're putting this on tape. Like, let's nail this. Or how does that feel?
Yeah. I mean, I think that comes into play. I think like more than anything, it's really in the sense of it might be easier to mix digitally for some things. It's all about practicality. So it's like, I can do digital quicker than I can do. I mean, I can do tape quicker than I can do digital. Mm. I'm more familiar with it. You know, Brian can be playing and overdubbing instruments, and I'll be able to engineer him quickly and get, maybe you have the idea of like somebody can do a full performance because it's not as easy to comp. It's not as easy to put things together. But really for me, it's just all about what the quicker and easier way to get a good sound. And it's easier and quicker to get a good sound on tape.
Yeah.
You have to manipulate stuff to get the computer to sound good. You have to do a lot of stuff that it's just always puzzling to me when somebody's opinion is the opposite about how difficult it is. Makes sense for certain kinds of music that are edit based and that are based on writing on the computer. We put down the rhythm track and then we try to improvise over it. Makes sense to do it that way, but it doesn't make sense when you write a song and you know what the arrangement is going to be,
especially the lyrics and stuff. It's like, if you know, it's also difficult.
If you're spitballing lyrics over tape, that might be kind of annoying because you can't just take one piece and put it, you know.
Yeah.
It's really nice to know too, when you're putting a vocal together, okay, do I really like this vocal? Because if I don't like this vocal, or if I kind of like this vocal, I'm about to record over it and it's about to be gone, you know?
Yeah. With decision making, for sure.
Yeah, I mean, that's got to mess with some of the like rawness of it, right? I mean, it, you know, because like there's stuff on your record, and I mean this in a loving way. Like, there's tiny little imperfections, but I think it sounds good. It sounds real. It sounds like a real record versus some things, I don't know, like say Max Martin or whatever, where it's like everything is pitch corrected, everything is, you know, air quoting correct, in sync, quantized, and this, like, there's just energy. I mean, it's really, really good. It's fun. I listen to it a lot.
That's great. You know, to me, it's like, if I'm working on the computer and I got to do you become obsessed with, I should really be doing it to the grid, you know, cause I have the grid. So I should do it to the grid. And then it's, I should really be, you know, or you have a take that might be more raw, really. And you decide that you have all these, you have eight options. And one of them, you're like, oh, I like my scream on that. Oh, I like my thing on that. What's nice about the tape is you don't really get to consider those kinds of things. It's like, and if you have an imperfection, it might be because you did one all the way through. And if you punch over that one part, it ruins the whole thing. Right. Then you're going to hear a punch. It's going to fuck it up. So then you end up leaving in just a little thing. Not like, I don't know. You don't have to, if you choose to put in an imperfection, it feels so phony.
Let's try this again and get pitchy on this chorus here. Yeah. No, I hear you. There's stuff like that too, especially when people really want to emulate certain records,
yeah.
You know, where Like they're like, oh, we're not going to, you know, run this mic through this. We're going to actually record to a PA and then we're going to mic the PA.
Yeah.
And then we're going to run that through, you know, some sort of weird compressor and crap to like get your thing. I mean, there's different tricks. I get it. But regardless, I mean, you guys did a great record. What's in terms of like how both of you have been writing? I mean, you're both, I'd argue, like basically virtuosos, like in the fact that you can play every instrument and all this stuff. Like how is like the songwriting going between both of you in terms of like, does someone like, no, this is my song, it's happening this way, or is it much more collaborative?
We tend to agree on you know, say if like a lyric is bad or whatever, it's like it is, we don't really write together very often, but we check each other, I think, you know, if a chord's is like, you know, generic or whatever, we'll tell each other, you know. But usually we kind of have an inclination on, you know, on that kind of thing beforehand, you know.
Yeah,
we're pretty in sync when it comes to those critiques. But yeah, we don't really write together very
often. Just record together, and we record, you know, sometimes things are slightly unfinished before you get them on record or something. So, you know, I got everything figured out except for this little bit right here or whatever. And so I'll be on the drums and Brian will be on the instrument that he wrote on, mm-hmm. and kind of figure out the structure more rock solid.
Yeah.
I mean, that's like how you would do it in a band, I guess. It's just the two of us instead. And then we do it vice versa the same way. Brian will be on the drums and I'll be on a rhythm instrument.
We mostly help with the arrangements of each other.
Yeah. We arrange it and then,
but we take certain roles. Like Michael is like the engineer responsible for the sound of the records. Mm-hmm. And then I'm like the arranger-ish for like the orchestrations. And we collaborate on the harmonies.
Yeah,
typically,
yeah.
You know?
Yeah, but then also we, you know, if it gets into the digital realm, there's a pretty clear, I don't know, we have roles and I don't really think either of us are that bothered by them. But like, I think like, if it's digital, though,
digital?
Oh, yeah, if it's digital, Brian usually, like, Brian was more the mixer for the last record. He really mixed it. I didn't really mix it.
Before was probably one. More of the mixer
for this one. Yeah, because it was analog and stuff. But, you know, I think he mixed a whole song without me, too.
Yeah, probably.
Yeah.
It just, but, you know, but wait, like, but it's so
cool. You know, it'd be like, can you just handle the vocals and I'll handle the instruments here and I'll bring this in. Often with the analog mixing is that way. You need more than one person to do it.
And we do really have this thing of like, even if I play all the instruments on a song, it doesn't really feel like I'm responsible for the whole song. Even if it's my song and I played all the instruments for a song.
Well, if your brain is so overwhelmed by playing all the instruments on a song and you're picking up literally the way he will do it a lot of times is picking up every instrument, doing the bass, kind of just playing and not really thinking about it as much.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll, you know, do that bit, switch that around. And it's kind of like a machine, you know? And if Brian can really be totally fluid, the way to get him to be totally fluid is by paying attention really hard because there aren't really engineers like that at this point. Because no engineer is invested in what. Yeah, well, maybe in our world,
it seems like every musician I've ever met is only really focused on their project.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
That sounds about right. Yeah,
even if they're helpful, even if you need to get someone on your recording, really
nowadays like, everybody's got their own thing, so everybody, that's what's good about,
and everybody's so underpaid too, it's like, you know, you can't, not even like a monetary like you know, incentive,
yeah,
to
exactly.
get someone to really
I think that
play
would,
well on your thing
that would probably be,
even though we have been lucky with like people playing well on our things, but it's like you do have to, you know, pay more attention and kind of
because
twist their arm
to me. I'm getting so much out of it by trying to get his thing to be as good as possible because it's got my name on it too, you know?
You know, I mean, for me, like the mental scenario of how people are recording, like what goes on in people's heads to make that happen? What are the compromises that have to take place? I mean, because like you're talking to someone too, at least for me, I listen to, you know, I'll listen to stuff in the car, you know, but I don't really like passively listen to music that much anymore.
Yeah.
It's more of like sit down, put it on, start to finish, you know, no distractions, don't have your phone out, don't start researching stuff, just sit and like experience it, you know? I mean, and it's like, I have a nice set of speakers at home, you know, I get a little bit nuts on like the quality of audio. Like I'm not listening to this like AAC stuff, whatever. Like it's gotta be the best. And so like, you know, especially too, as someone who, I mean, how something is made is almost more important than how something is performed. You know, I mean, like, I'm sure you all have dug into, you know, Dylan records and stuff that have been recorded, or things that go like 3-4 times, you know, different studios, scenarios, start to finish. I mean, that stuff to me just really, really like gets me the most amped.
Yeah. Yeah. It does help. It helps when you know, it's kind of the same idea as that engineered that record too. I got to check that record out, you know?
Yeah. It's right.
It gives you some kind of like thing to think about while you're listening to the music. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Well, I mean, that being said, like, were there specific records or people on the other side, you know, people on the other side of the board that really inspired you or made you try to emulate certain sounds?
This band Tagus is a Swedish band that have a record from 1967 called Studio. And it's like, it's this post, I think it's like, must be right after Sgt. Pepper or like even slightly before. But definitely
it's gotta be before.
But it's the same year, you know. So
yeah.
But it's like one of these post Sgt. Pepper psychedelic masterpiece records, you know. But it was one that we hadn't ever heard before. So
a few years ago now. It's gotta be.
Sure.
It's so inspiring when you hear something like that, because it's like, you know, it makes you feel like you can make one too, you know? Because it's like you've gone your whole life not hearing it. And
I don't know if we were striving necessarily to make one of those records, because this record is kind of a bit of a, we pulled things, like we pulled one song that was supposed to be on the last record, and then we pulled one song that was quite a bit older too, but certainly sonically, like a lot of compression and stuff. A lot of the same instrumentation. And
yeah, it's also super ambitious arrangements. But pop writing that you can understand the first time you hear it, you know?
Yeah. I mean, it's super catchy. It's good. Like, I remember, do you remember that band Rockin' Horse? I'm sure people I think like Biggest Gossip in Town or Yes It Is. I think they were like a Light in the Attic band. Yeah. But, you know, when you listen to records of that era, it's funny because you had mentioned compression, right? Like there wasn't a ton of compression on these things. You know, it would only sound like that when you would hear like a radio cut, because it would just be like smashed to shit so they could boost it up. And the amount of like sonic space on your guys' recordings, I mean, it's great. Like that's why If You and I Are Not Wise, like that track, like it, I don't know. It's almost like I can hear the room, and I might even just be making that up. And you're like, dude, I did it in the closet. Chill. Like, but I mean, it's good.
I think I think on those records, I don't know if they're, I think on Rockin' Horse, I don't know if there's tons of compression, but on this Tagus record, there's definitely a lot. But I think that the compression isn't, it's not like on the whole track.
Yeah.
Track. It's like on individual tracks, and then certain ones are fused together. Like, on a lot of Beatle records, it'll be drums and something else, and they'll put those together. And every time they do it, they put it through a compressor. Well, a lot of those consoles even had compressors on each channel strip.
Mm-hmm.
But there is still space, because I think that everything in and of itself isn't being compressed together. There's certain records, of course, that are. But that's the modern thing, is everything squashed
together
at the end.
Yeah.
Which not really the way, to me, it's like the sound is bussing things together, squashing them, or not really squashing, but, you know, compressing them and putting them on one track. And there's a lot of what we did on this record, a lot was fully left, fully right, you know, mm-hmm. a lot of that kind of panning, all the strings on the left, all the trumpets on the right or something.
And that creates space. You know?
Yeah. So on the close, because I got to talk about this stuff too. I think you guys, explain to me some of your guys's like clothes and style here, because you're very much, I don't know if it's subscribed 100% like to the fit, but like every time I've seen you in different eras, even seeing you guys play live, your style is like incredible. Where did this come from? And like the vintage and the, I don't know, walk me through this.
In high school, I got really into wearing like paisley shirts and, you know, stuff like that. because I was obsessed with like early Pink Floyd. Okay. And, you know, I would get my hair cut like Roger Waters or something, you know, show a picture of him to my friend who would cut my hair.
I guess we started shopping in vintage stores and stuff like that in high school. And I don't know, really. I can't say. I always felt like, you know, you do like maybe seeing Foxygen and stuff. They thought they were like, thought that Sam was like, just would dress like whoever he liked, you know, and didn't have like a barrier against doing that. Like, oh, I can, you know, make records that sound like this, but I don't want to like look like that. That would be corny. You know what I mean? Yeah. I think I definitely heard people say very similar things to that.
Yeah.
But I just kind of thought you just do whatever you want. So I think I always think it now I've settled into what I was into in high school really was things that were neat and went together. Cause I kind of felt like I had like a little bit of that. I didn't want to say like everybody says, like I had a little OCD, but I always felt like I really liked things to be neat and stuff. And trying to like put things together in a loose way, like Keith Richards, like somebody who's like that, like who's really that was very difficult for me, but I had tried to do that at points. But now I kind of like neat, like having a neat. It just comes easier, more naturally to me.
Wait a second. I got to get my bids in on the Bezel app, but more on that in a minute. I get all sorts of emails and questions from you all, which I love to read and respond. And one thing I constantly get, and even read in the Blammo Slack, is what watch should I buy and where should I get it? It's a wild world out there with all sorts of websites and shops, but I go to Bezel. Bezel is the trusted marketplace for buying and selling your next luxury watch with expert in-house authentication on every purchase. First off, folks, it's getbezel.com. That's getbezel.com. But I use and recommend Bezel because it's the best of both worlds. You can go to the site and browse a marketplace of luxury watches, over 16,000 of them, by the way, which is a lot. And I know that Bezel is going to authenticate your purchase. Or you can create an account and get connected with your own private client advisor called the concierge. Because look, making a watch purchase can be confusing, especially when you don't know all the reference numbers. When was this made? Did they use ceramic then? Is it a triple lop, dingle dop? You know, what the heck? I don't even know. But they do at Bezel, and they're here to help. Concierge, baby! Look, if looking for your watch to mark a special occasion, or maybe you're just doing research, right? They even have their own journal where you can learn all the ins and outs about Bezel and the brands and all the stuff that's happening right now. But back to my bids. Yes, Bezel now has auctions. And not just any auctions. They got Rolex, they got Cartier, they got Audemars Piguet, all the big dogs and more. So you can discover, bid, and know the Bezel team has got your back with verified in-house authentication. So visit getbezel.com on your smartphone or computer. Bezel, the trusted marketplace for buying or selling your next luxury watch.
Yeah, I mean, are there like, do you only shop vintage or?
Yeah, I mean, I've been given things before and that aren't vintage or, you know, buy new underwear.
Well, I figured that. Yeah, yeah.
Also, I mean, some people don't, you know. I don't care. I mean, it could be anything, but I like that stuff. But I like everything. Like, I like when things feel nice and when things, like nice furniture I don't really have, but I like that stuff. Nice lamps, nice guitars. I'm a material person. I like compressors and stuff like that. So it just extends to that. You know, it's all...
But it's all that stuff's a very specific era. I mean, you have kind of like, you know, late 60s, early to mid 70s. I mean, it's kind of a golden era in terms of the advantages of industrial manufacturing, but not like watered down, diluted crap. I mean, you know, I mean, you have like, at least from a clothing standpoint, the only thing that happened in the 70s on clothing that they didn't do as much is polyester. And now most of that stuff is in athletic gear. But like, you know, my dad had a Nutter suit. I don't know if you guys know Nutter. So Tommy Nutter and Edward Sexton invented and created the, I mean, when you look at suits of Elton John, Rolling Stones, Mick Jagger suit when he married Bianca Jagger, like that was all Nutter's. And Nutter's was like one of the first Savile Row spots that made like that style suit, which like think strong shoulders, you know, lower gorge. So that's like where the collar meets the lapel, is like much lower on the chest, you know, that kind of like classic stuff. When, if you look at like a Gucci ad right now and you're seeing, you know, Jared Leto wear a Gucci, that's like a nutter suit. And a lot of that stuff had like poly blends and stuff into it. But like it, even now, and I think because of like this era of like eBay and Depop and then vintage stores, like it's hard to find that stuff. So, I mean, do you guys just like, you know, just get whatever you can when you're on the road? Like, do you like set aside time to shop, or is it just like, no, man, this is an afterthought?
Well, they don't say, we don't set aside time. There's nothing but time to do that kind of like we go shopping a lot on the road in between soundcheck and the show.
Okay,
that's really all there is to do, and then or eat.
Yeah, I mean we have time.
Yeah, I try to go shopping in town here when there's like a video coming up or something. I find that we don't have the best in New York. The best vintage clothes, I don't think.
You're right. I mean, like, so I used to live there for a long time, and then I commute there. And vintage is good, but the thing is, like, vintage, right? Like, in your head, if I said vintage, what year do you think?
Like 60s, 70s, I think.
Right, which is what I think is correct. But now vintage is just 20 years ago. So technically vintage is 2004.
Yeah.
There's nothing in 2004 in my head that's vintage. Like, it's just, so, like, with that in mind, it's just harder to find good stuff. Or it's like, cool, do you want this 1930s frock coat? It's like, yeah. No, fam. Like, you know.
There's definitely a lot of, like, 90s Y2K, like, stuff here, for sure.
It's
here. It has been for, like, a long time here. It's been big for, like, a super long time. What seems like a long time here. I feel like
you mean like the dime square aesthetic, like the the silver tab jeans and the, you know, oversized shirts and stuff like that. Like, I get it. I respect it. It's cool. But I don't know. It's no Lemon Twigs. Just saying.
Well, I don't think I think that they're just dressing like they're heroes. Right. And that's what I just like, you know, music from that era. And it's just fun. And the stuff is nice. You know, this is a nice,
that's a Hang Ten shirt, right?
Yeah. And it's not as good.
Yeah. It looks sick as fuck. What about your shirt collar there? You got this super, super long pointed collar.
This isn't vintage. See, I wear so much stuff of my girlfriend Anastasia, and she gets mad at me sometimes, but also she lets me wear it and gets me a lot of stuff. I have a little bit more of
this used to be my shirt
passive relationship to the whole thing, and Michael gets me a lot of stuff, and but I, you know, I go with him a lot, and so I pick up the odd thing, but I also don't, you know, get sick of my clothes as quickly as Michael does. So I have stuff that I've gotten that I got, like, you know, close to 10 years ago that I still
stuff that I've gotten a long time ago. Like, I think you just, as you go, you kind of,
but what
hair down, deal? What it is that you really, really do like.
What is the deal with the
shirt?
Sweater.
Oh, no, the sweater?
The shirt is not vintage.
The shirt is vintage.
Yeah, but the sweater, you're saying.
Yeah.
That's the scoop.
And we're hype.
It was always really weird though, because when our first album came out, we would do a lot of fashion magazines and stuff.
It was always embarrassing. It was horrible.
And the whole photo shoot, we would, the people there would be trying to convince us to wear all of the stuff that was like just completely not our style at all. You know?
Oh.
Like, remember this guy was wearing like this super oversized shirt, like it ends oversized pants. Like, you know, like it was like
20 times too big, you know, it was like bigger, not like a 90s fit or something.
It was like the David Byrne thing, kind of like that.
Yeah, but it wasn't like cool. It was like baggy. Like it was super, it was ridiculous, but it was super fashion-y.
And he pulled out this gigantic shirt.
They said, you got to wear this.
Exactly the same proportions to us as like what he was wearing. It was like, there's something about this, I think, that I like.
Yeah, we were like, I just don't think I like that like fit. He was like, I think like super, super tiny.
Good accent.
Super huge. Like, I don't know. I think he might have been Australian or some shit. They're always like Australian or like Irish or something. He was like, well, or some shit. I don't know. Northern, I don't know. They're like super huge and or like super tiny. I'm like, what about like the right size?
That'd be good. Yeah, man, that's... The fashion world's weird, man. It's and the funny thing is, like, at the end of the day, a lot of fashion is like trying to get someone to look like themselves. And so when you look at these shoots and stuff, especially for, it's a shoot of a personality. So like someone like yourself or some celebrity or whatever. It's like, no, like I'm the draw. Like that's the point. So me looking like me is what you want versus me cosplaying as, you know, a Sith Lord. That's not going to fly.
You can always tell when somebody's a number of things that they're clearly uncomfortable in.
Well, I'm sure the summer tour or whatever. Yeah.
A lot.
Different era, different time. I mean, cause you guys have been, how long have you been playing music? Like actively as Lemon Twigs?
Oh, as a Lemon Twig since I was 14.
Okay. 15 or 16 or whatever. It was when we started making some headway.
But 2015.
In the industry.
Okay, but when we were at the Lemon Twig, that was 2014. Yeah.
Okay, so you got a decade under your belt. So yeah, you got different eras. I mean, you think about the Beatles and everyone else, like you're moving out of those other eras and now you're hitting your prime, right?
We're about to break up. We're at the White Album.
You know what, we can start it when I was, you know, George's age or whatever. We don't have to start the clock
that's like, at 14.
No, that's not.
I mean, you have to, you know, there has to be some sort of like interest that builds up as the human lifespans get like older or whatever. Like, you know, maybe we started like when we're like, you know, 20.
No, that would be
as
great.
Opposed to 20.
I always try to tell myself that, you know, well, you know, whoever it is that I'm thinking about currently, like they didn't start until they were like my age right now. So none of that stuff counts, but it doesn't work with the Beatles because they were,
when I was about to turn 25 and I realized that I hadn't done my Pet Sounds yet. That was a difficult.
I'm about to turn 25 and I don't feel that
you've done your Pet Sounds.
Well, I'm.
So you haven't done your Pet Sounds.
End of interview.
Yeah.
Anyway.
No, I mean, I think it's interesting that you think that way. And I feel like that's like a human thing, right? Where we're constantly measuring our success and achievements against the people that we admire. But like, if you want to zoom way out here, you mentioned Brian Wilson, right? Brian Wilson, sadly, unfortunately, just lost his partner, his wife. And now there's a conservatorship that's going to be put over him. The dude peaked. It doesn't mean he's not a good artist. It doesn't mean his work didn't matter. But like, imagine if you peak at the age you are now. Like that sucks. Like your whole, I mean, aging and, you know, and getting and improving and learning and stuff, like it's always going to happen. And so like, I think it can also be a curse. You know, if you think, okay, shit, you did your Pet Sounds 2 years ago. All right, well, game over. You can collect a check, but like, what are you going to do?
Yeah. I mean, that's something that you end up thinking about, you know, in your darkest moments or whatever. But it's not something that, If you're constantly making music, you know, that's not something that factors into your thinking a lot, you know. And obviously we don't care about, you know, it being something that's appreciated or like something that is like known by other people as like a classic album or whatever. It's just, we just want to be able to make records that we feel like fully satisfied.
Yeah, we listen to it all the way through and we go, that's incredible. I think it did take longer for us to start to get records like that. Like, I think we feel that way about our last record and our new record. But I think a lot of that may have to do with having disparate interests. And like, we were completely also not only focused on writing, but also focused on learning engineering, also focused on learning arranging, doing live shows, trying to pay attention to the business a little bit to not get screwed. You know what I mean? I mean, it's like, there's so many factors that you think about when you're not at Abbey Road with a endless amount of money, able to just record for hours and hours and hours. It's like, you got to figure out how to get perfect in this amount of time. Do you know what I mean? So it's kind of like, I don't know. It's just a totally different development than like the development. But that's what's so amazing about people like Emmett Rhodes and people who do it themselves. And
yeah,
I don't know, just somebody who's able to crystallize something so well without the resources of one of these huge, huge, huge bands, you know?
I mean, it's true. I think like when you have the machine behind you, it can be a little bit difficult to focus and have your own sort of pure artistic intent, because if you have, you know, and when I mean like the machine, I mean like a full sort of squad or like super label industrial complex or whatever that's behind you. And it's like, oh, we have this strategy and this. And because we have an advance of this, we have to spend this much on the record. And that means we got to hire this super producer. And it's like, well, what the hell? Like it removes some of the art that made you all, you know, good to begin with. And I think like that's the fine line as any musician matures, into which like I root for all of them. But sometimes we're like, whoa, there's just too much like business in this. Like it just feels, yeah.
I just think that if you could really do whatever you want, like if we could get an orchestra to play, you know what I mean? If like, mm-hmm. if we were able to do that, then it's just different from recording your own strings and stuff like that, or getting the odd string player or whatever. It's just different to be able to go into a real studio with seven engineers or whatever, and just, you can kind of get what's in your mind out or better with like none of this, figuring out how do we do it? How do we, you know, it's like that part of it can be kind of stifling,
but for really ambitious stuff, it can be stifling, but then also it can,
create something new. Like in the case of, I guess, Roy Wood or something. No, that's not what he wanted to do. He just was doing that. That was his vision to do it himself.
You say like, I just spent money to hire a string quartet and I spent too much money. So now I'm going to do an album playing all the strings, say hypothetically. I'm gonna do all the strings. That's creative. That's creativity at work.
That's a good well you're pulling from. Yeah. Sounds good. When you guys start your tour?
We're gonna start rehearsing like next month, when our drummer who lives in LA, but he's gonna be staying in New York for like 2 months before the tour.
Yeah,
we're gonna be a purse. A ton. It's going to be super fun.
Is this the same crew from the Fallon?
Yes.
Sonic. I mean, you guys played so incredibly tight. Like, and I'll say this as a person who's seen a lot of bands on Fallon and live and in person. It's hard to sound good in there. Yeah. It's really hard to sound good. It's almost like a TV curse where it's like almost every band sounds bad on SNL and stuff, but like it's hard to sound good. And you guys sounded really, really tight. Like the mix, did you watch the video and hear the mix? I mean, it's great.
Oh yes. Only 300 times.
Michael's finest moment, really.
Yeah. So certain. I prepared a lot to try to make sure nothing would go wrong.
The fact that we weren't doing a tour at the same time was like so helpful, because what happens to us, obviously, it happens to everybody.
Well, it's a catch-22.
Our voices get kind of worn out, you know, after a tour and stuff. So
we were worried because we weren't on a tour recently that we wouldn't be super tight.
Mm-hmm.
But then we knew that also the voice thing was a factor. It's like, if you can get, for us, if you can get like 2 or 3 days before where you haven't sung at all, it's like your voice, or my voice personally, can be so much better than just if I just sang the day before. Mm. It's just, it's a huge toll.
But yeah, I was practicing.
I have a sensitive voice, I think.
Yeah.
I smashed my hand through a glass.
Yeah, that's right.
A glass five minutes
before we went on.
Because I was practicing. I wanted to practice my windmill. I wanted to know exactly where I was going to do it, which not very rock and roll.
So
we were in the tiny dressing room, and there was like a glass.
Well, I just wanted to say that we were in the tiny dressing room because we had some friends with us, and we had and then the label and publicity were there. So the whole big dressing room was filled with people. So
oh my God.
In this little room with the
there's floor. A glass casing hanging on the wall, and I did my last windmill, and I put a lot of emphasis on it, and I my hand was bleeding. I had to go to the nurse. She had to patch me up, and she did a really good job. Blood was not pouring down my hand or anything.
I mean, you didn't notice it on the performance.
But yeah, I was like shaking.
Yeah, he was shaking up because of that.
You know? It's just like, I just didn't know if I was going to be affected by that or whatever.
Oh yeah, I'm proud to say that humbly, I was the glue.
Mm.
I was the guy who was rallying the troops. Humbly, I just want to say that humbly.
That's very helpful of you.
Yeah. But I think we just made sure the guitars weren't too distorted.
Anyway, I think that's enough on that.
Oh no, but how we sounded good. The drums. There's so many factors
just
on why.
Just take the compliment.
No, but seriously, there's a lot of factors on why it sounded good. Well, one thing would be that we were lip syncing, and then it was a track.
Yeah, that helped.
There you go. Yeah, there that's you go. You heard it here first, folks. Yeah, imagine you have your Ashley Simpson moment, you know, and you just do a hunky dory dance on the stage. One night I was.
What was it like that?
Yeah, it was. It was like a jig. I felt bad. Like my friends and I, we were hanging out. I think one of us was stoned or something. It might have even been all of us or me. And we were like, yo, you remember Ashley Simpson on SNL. And he was like, no, what are you talking about? And he pulled up his phone, he showed it. And I was like, oh my God. Cause they left it, like they left the camera on, like just on her. And then the band was just like, well, fuck it. Here we go. And they just tear into the chorus. And they're like zooming in on the musicians, like going into the chorus. And then they eventually just like cut. I was like, oh man, it's a
nightmare.
Yeah. Well, at least you guys don't have to deal with that.
Yeah. I mean,
the worst we can do is just
break a string or something.
Sound horrible the whole time.
Reza did break a stick. He broke a stick at the end there, but he got lucky that it was at the end.
I don't know how you guys play on gear so old and manage to make it work. You know, so my dad had a Moog and a Rhodes and all this stuff. He had an Opus 3, a Mini Moog and all that. And he said they were the worst things to tour with ever because phones, this is in the 80s and 90s and like when cell phones started to come in. So this is before, I don't know what megahertz it was. Like they would have to wrap the inside of the Rhodes in foil to try to protect it because they would be playing and it would just cut out. There would be all these issues. So like, I don't know how you guys tour with such, you know, fragile gear.
Yeah, we've been lucky with the, because we usually tour with a Wurlitzer and haven't had very many problems with that. But we used to have a lot of problems. We used to always break, tines on the Wurlitzer, and you know that note would just be gone for the rest of the shows. Our main thing didn't really matter at that point because we had a bigger band and we had like two guitars and keyboard.
Yeah.
But nowadays it's we've been lucky with the Wurlitzer or whatever.
Our main thing now is trying to pare down and figure out what the smallest, lightest gear that we can use would be, which without, you know, compromising having cool vintage stuff. I always liked, when I was playing more drums in the band, I always liked vintage hardware because it's so light.
Mm-hmm.
And playing, and our drummer now, who's really into old stuff, and you know, he's like us with that stuff, but he doesn't like the old hardware because it's floppy, and you know, it can. And he's a little bit more intense than I am with the. I just like old stuff. The reason that we use that stuff is because it's bought for recording, and I just always thought it looked cooler to bring that out.
It does. Yeah. I mean, if you walk out with a cool Dan Electro or even like some sort of Vox Teardrop, whatever, like they look sick, but they're hard to keep the intonation and stuff correct. I mean, it's tough. You get why some people just like play with a Strat or a Tele, you know, I mean, there's nothing wrong with it, but it's just, it's tough to get that sound. But the worst thing you ever would be is a friend of mine was in a band. I won't name his band because he listens to this. And they got a Rhodes like set and they took it all apart and then they dropped a Nord in there.
Yeah.
And so it looks like a Rhodes, but it's not. Yeah. It's a Nord. And they're like, we just do this because it, you know, it looks cool and they don't have to deal with it. And so I was like, I guess that works, but you know.
It makes sense. But the thing for me is would be that now I have this extra fucking thing with that I have to bring out of the car every fucking time. Extra thing. And then I also have the Nord. It defeats the purpose for me. For me, it's like, just, I wish we just didn't have to use the keyboard, but we have to use the keyboard because some of the songs good with keyboard. I don't like, we have a 12 string. We have a six
string. The Rickenbacker 12 string too, right? Or am I wrong?
Well, Brian was using a Gibson 12 string on that program, but it was, we have a 12 string, a six string and an acoustic nylon string that Brian brings. Jeez. So that he can play live. And I find that all that to be a pain in the ass because it's so much extra shit, but there's not really any way to get around it. It really fucks up the set if you don't have the cool stuff. Yeah.
You gotta get a tech, I guess. That sucks. That costs money.
We like the group that we're with is like super.
Oh yeah, they're great. And it's
fun to have sort of a small.
Yeah, honestly.
Small group.
A little bit more of an intimate group in the car.
When we first got started, we, you know, toured like we were like a huge band. So we would tour with like a lighting person and like a sound person.
That was only like one
tour, yeah.
Yeah.
But that whole experience is just sucks. It I don't know. Like on a bus, you know, it's like it's not as fun.
No,
it's like you're like on a bus, you know.
Are you guys in like a Sprinter now or?
Yeah, a van.
Yeah. But it's like it doesn't feel like you're going to all these places, you know. It just feels like you're like in a tube and anywhere.
Just rolling along, dude. What's the thing you always say?
We're just a couple of troubadours.
You know, fucking troubadour.
Being a man is not unlike being a citizen of the world.
Yeah, I mean, if you if you get in that situation and you're playing and you're in one of those like dashboard confessional buses, or you turn into one of those bands and you have like six or seven different buses and you don't know what city and what town you're in, it's going to make it hard to keep the cool guy, edgy band, you know, when you're just like, I don't know where the hell I am. And I'm upset that my latte is, you know, not hot enough.
Yeah. Well, we're edgy. We're super edgy and super on the edge, super on the cutting edge of what's new too.
Yeah.
And, we're in hate lattes.
Before we wrap, I want to talk to you guys about office hours, because I think you get name checked on that pod more than ever. What's your relationship with Tim Heidecker?
I didn't know that, but we played on one of his records. We've seen him live a few times. We hang out with him when he's in town, just like at his shows.
Yeah,
at his show. Like we have before, you know. Yeah, we're a fan of his and think he's a fan of ours. And yeah,
we met him through Rado from Fox, was producing some of his stuff and who produced our first record. And we've always worked with, you know, on and off for years. But yeah, we just like him. I watch the podcast, but I haven't seen that happen for a while, probably.
I think you were name checked on this past week's episode because my wife, who is a diehard Office Hours fan, she's like, oh my God, she's like, the Lemon Twigs get name checked all the time on Office Hours. And I was like, really? Okay, I'll go tell him. And
cool. Yeah. We'll definitely watch that.
Oh yeah, I'll scrub.
you got to scrub or use some sort of AI that like...
And then it'll get the most replayed because I'll just watch it over and over again. Along with the Fallon.
What are some of your guys' favorite YouTube videos? You sound like a YouTube expert. Where do you go?
I like the video of
Eric Carmen getting pulled
disgraced
over
actor Kevin Spacey doing the singing John Lennon's Mind Games. That's one of my favorite videos of all time. He delivers some crazy speech before. And then he does like a fun little jump as the song starts.
Yes.
What about the
Pete Townsend one that you posted where this is for the kids?
Yeah, Pete Townsend on David Letterman playing Pinball Wizard on acoustic guitar. And then he smashes his guitar, I think with the intention of donating the smash guitar to charity, but he doesn't really explain that. And it's kind of an odd clip.
He goes, this is for all those kids, do it for charity. And then he smashes the guitar.
Let's do something for the world. Let's do something good for those kids, for charity.
That's a good clip.
I'm trying to think of really.
I like
really
the video
good
of the clip of Art Garfunkel. Rado showed us that years ago. Art Garfunkel in the studio, all the studio chatter of him.
What about the great one that you found?
Making the engineer's life a living hell.
Then they did on Office Hours, the one that you found.
Oh, the video of Art Garfunkel.
Is a connection.
There you go.
It was an interview.
Bob Costas.
Yes. What was the kind of punchline of that? It was like,
I don't know. I posted it on my YouTube channel. Lemon Twigs fan Scotty Fillmore. Lemon Twigs Scotty Fillmore.
His YouTube
posted
channel.
Posted that on YouTube.
What was the?
We're sort of mutual fans. Wow.
What was the clip though? What does he do? What is Art Garfunkel doing at?
I don't know. He's just being himself.
He negates himself immediately. That was the idea of it.
Oh yeah. Bob Costas sets up, he asks him like, what do you say to people who say Art Garfunkel's albums are
soft,
saccharine, too sweet? He just sort of like insults him to his face.
Kinda. Well, no, not really.
And he says,
it's a good interview.
He says, who are these people who write such things? I would say appeal was more to the females, the females who like that sort of sultry sound. And furthermore, if I let my defense down for a second, I would say they probably have a point. I like
he
has this moment of like a self-reflection where he sees like how defensive he is, and then he just completely has the opposite opinion of, you know, he kind of gives them props, you know,
yeah,
for criticism, which is, yeah, I think part of what makes him a great artist.
Yeah.
I don't know about that one.
Well,
agree to disagree.
There's no Art Garfunkel fan on this side of the mic.
Bright Eyes by Art Garfunkel.
We have strength in numbers.
Is a beautiful, beautiful.
Really?
Solo.
So you guys are art stands. Okay. Respect.
Well, not necessarily his solo work, but he's a great actor, and he yeah. is a fantastic actor. Carnal Knowledge and Catch-22.
Yeah, and then the what's the movie that
the Nicholas really Nicholas Rogue?
Yeah.
Anyway, I can't remember, but not as a solo artist, although there are great. Some songs that are great.
Yeah.
His contributions to Simon and Garfunkel are, I think... You can't deny them. And I don't think it's just his voice. I believe him when he says that he contributed so much because he's so picky and so...
Opinionated.
There's no way that he was keeping his mouth shut in the studio. He's probably constantly contributing because he could never not. Couldn't turn it off.
Yeah.
Tom and Jerry, man. That was them.
Yeah.
You know what's crazy?
Recording is great too.
Bad Timing. Yeah. That's this road movie.
Whenever I look up artists and I love to watch old Dick Cavett videos, especially, there's great stuff with Paul Simon, George Harrison, and all that stuff in there. But you realize that because Paul Simon made so much of his career before Simon and Garfunkel and Tom and Jerry and all that stuff, just writing songs for other people, dude was pretty rich and had a pretty wild publishing catalog because he got to keep the majority of all of his publishing. And so when you think of artists who, don't really need to make music, people like him and Billy Joel, they own all their music more or less. And so they just were always stacked. And that's where a lot of legal issues and arguments came from is that. And then also Paul Simon was just so pissed off because they would keep the spotlight on Art for Bridge Over Troubled Water. And he was that was my song, motherfucker.
But who doesn't?
Yeah, but he's,
struck me as a story that was so petty. It's the story he always tells. Yeah, it's
I think he's a
narcissist. I love it. Carfunkel would, credit the piano player, Larry Nechtel. And he wouldn't credit me.
I know. Can you believe that? It's dude, you're rich. You made it. You're fine. Chill.
Let him have the spotlight.
Yeah. Everybody knows your solo career. Well, I guess, would he say that before?
He said that was a contributing factor.
Yeah. Going solo. Well, once that was done.
Yeah. Sometimes it's just never.
I don't think he was underappreciated
enough for people.
Right. Exactly.
Touché. So Art Garfunkel lives at the Dakota Building, and Paul Simon wanted to move in there at one point. And in order to get accepted in there, you have to go through the board and everyone has to vet you and all this stuff. It's a pretty, snobby place, right? And Art was like, "Nah, fam, you're not moving in here." And so yeah. So there's a fun story for you of their vendetta that, never went away.
That's not cool. I'm gonna.
He didn't want to see him. He's like, get the fuck out of my building, man.
Yeah, they're petty, dude.
Yeah.
They're
see, this is why it's good. You guys are brothers. You don't have to deal with this stuff.
Well, I don't know.
I mean,
petty. You know,
it can be petty. Yeah.
Every person is fallible.
I just think that because Art Garfunkel is so, with his language, is so obviously kind of douchey. Because he's so flowery in his language and the way that he talks, so particular, and that he gets a really bad rap. Although we've heard from people, it's horrible.
Well, he
worked with them.
Well, he sent our dad a really mean letter.
If I can say that, I don't think he would care if we told that story, but my dad sent him a song and he
a beautiful song, by the way.
Wonderful song, yeah.
Fantastic song.
And a demo or something or a full recording and would you do this or be interested in it? And he wrote back. He took the trouble to write back and wrote, "Thanks, but no thanks." It's just terrible. All I'm saying is that I don't think he's much worse than Paul Simon.
We just completely and any
there's our heroes,
yeah,
but I just mean I don't think he's that much worse, but I don't know if I met him, maybe he would be.
Hey, kill your idols, man. That's the only way to live.
I don't want to meet, but I would like to meet Paul Simon.
And not anymore. I would before this interview.
they're awesome and every, but I just mean there's a people take apart, they dissect these people and stuff, and
we dissect these people and their personalities and probably completely inaccurate
ways
all the time.
We even perceive people in normal life definitely incorrectly. Wrong all the time. I always think that people intend, you know, I'm paranoid, you know.
Did you guys ever meet Elton John?
We met him on the FaceTime, on the Zoom.
Yeah. And?
And he was great. Cool. He gave us a call when our first album came out.
Yeah.
Just not on the air or anything. You know, he just said he likes to take the time to tell people who he likes that they're doing good stuff, because he got a nice call from George Harrison when he started, you know.
And, oh my God, oh, Brian, this is a pipe dream of mine, but if we ever get to be on the couch, what? I'm going to tell that story.
What do you mean?
Like, you know,
on Seth Meyers?
On Seth Meyers, yeah.
Seth Meyers is your dream? That'll happen in a few weeks, guys. You'll be fine. But well, thanks, guys. It was great to chat with you and have you on. Congrats on the record. We'll see ya.
Thank you.
Same here.
You've been listening to Blammo. Our show is produced by Blammo Media. We're edited by Amar Lowell, and our theme music, as always, by the mysterious Breakmaster Cylinder. If you like what you heard, you know the drill. Share the pod with a friend. Leave a review on Apple Podcasts. Give us 5 stars or thumbs up on whatever other thing you're listening to us on, whether it's Dingledorp or Bing Bong, whatever it's called. But you can also follow us on Instagram for all the hot content. If you want to talk to us and give us your hot take, we'd love to hear from you. You can send us an email at info@blammopod.com. Last but not least, super ultra important, if I had an air horn, I would press it right now. You got to come and join us over on Patreon, because the fun never stops over there. Look, the live show, the free show, whatever you want to call this, we take breaks here and there, but Patreon, it never stops. And we also got exclusive shows like Die Workwear, hosted by Derek Guy and Peter Zatolo, and the Triple J Show, hosted by yours truly with John Moy and Gene Noyan. There's just a ton of stuff over there. So check it out at patreon.com/Blammo. If not, no worries. We got hundreds and hundreds of free episodes in the feed, and more to come. So we will see you all soon.